kind of the high joy and privilege to be with you this day, to be assembled in the house of God and in the service of God. I so very much appreciate all that's gone before. As Brother Mike was praying, and I very much appreciated his prayer, it reminded me of something that I came across a week or two ago. It was sent to me as kind of a, can you believe this kind of thing. Somebody had put forth the idea that if A, Christians believed what they said they believed, and B, were doing what they say they're doing, this situation is evidence that there is no God, because obviously they would be praying if they said they were doing what they were supposed to be doing. And if God was real, things would have obviously gotten better. So prayer either A, doesn't work, or God is not real, does not exist. I want to tell you something, friends. If God is not real, you wouldn't be able to imagine how dark this world would be right now. And if prayer didn't work, you cannot imagine how dark this world would be right now. I'm very thankful for the prayers that have gone up from God's people in recent days, throughout the days of the years of our life here. Because I'm going to tell you something. God is not sitting in heaven unaware of what's happening right now. God is very well aware of what's going on. His eye is still upon His people. We're still the apple of His eye. And nothing that ever happens in this world is going to change that. I don't care how bad this world looks. Friends, there is a light that still comes up every morning. And that light is a testimony to His light, to His power and to His goodness, as He is the one who's established it. So I very much appreciate the prayer that Brother Mike offered, the prayers that all of you have offered this day and this week, for the service and in my behalf, and ask that you continue in prayer. I'd like to begin this morning in a familiar place. It's Psalm 17, verse 15, where David is closing this psalm. He says, it's very familiar, he says, "As for me, I shall behold thy face in righteousness, and I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness." This verse has been used a lot, and I intend to begin here and end here. Talk about a subject that I'll confess to you, I am very poor at executing, and to date, I've been very wrong in how I proclaim the subject. The subject this morning is being satisfied, or satisfaction. David here, as he's describing events that he goes through in life in Psalm 17, says that he is expecting a day when he is going to appear in a way different than he is now. He's going to awake with the likeness of God. He said, I'm going to behold something I don't behold now. I'm going to behold thy face in righteousness. And I have often said, and I've been wrong in that, I've often said he was also expecting to do something that he could not do here, and that is be satisfied. I have incorrectly said in the past that it's impossible for us to be satisfied here in this world. The Bible is our only rule of faith and practice, it's our guide. And the Bible declares that we can be satisfied here. It declares that we can have a measure of satisfaction in this world in which we live. And it's hard and it's difficult. And this morning we'd like to look at the three ways in general the Bible talks about us being satisfied or able to be satisfied in this world. And in so doing, get back to Psalm 17:15 and bring it all home as David did at the end of this psalm. To begin with, what is satisfied? What is satisfaction? And how does it compare to something like being content? Or maybe we could say having a sufficiency of something. To be content is being able to have a measure of sufficiency no matter what circumstance you're in. For example, the Apostle Paul says in Philippians 4, in about verses 10 and 11, he said, I both know how to abound and know how to be abased. I know how to be full, and I know how to be hungry. And he said, and I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. Contentment isn't something that happens because of a circumstance. Contentment can be had no matter a circumstance, because Paul said, I was able to learn how to do it when I was up and when I was down, in good times and in bad. But to be satisfied is not something that is necessarily learned. Satisfaction is something that is tied to an event, or it's tied to a case in your life. For example, the term satisfied literally means, number one, its number one definition is, being fully supplied, being fully sufficient. And the second definition to it, which is kind of an auxiliary, is to be overflowing and abounding. So to be satisfied is tied to circumstances, tied to an event, tied to a thing that brings us a measure of fullness, a measure of sufficiency, and even in some cases an overflowing and an abounding. Notice the very first way in which we can be satisfied here in this world is found in Proverbs chapter 12. In Proverbs chapter 12, and about verse 11, a very important point for the world in which we live today, it says, "He that tilleth his land shall be satisfied with bread." It's a very important principle that Solomon is here espousing, that if you till your land, you'll be satisfied with bread. What he's describing in a general way is how we can receive satisfaction in the works of our hands that God has blessed us with, in the works of our hands that bring a product such as natural sustenance and natural food. You know, it's very easy to see why in the world in which we live today, and this is, I know, going out over the internet, so y'all bear with me. It's very easy to see in the world in which we live today how few people are satisfied, because we see in a world today how more and more people do not work. You know, if you don't work, you're not going to be satisfied with the product of your hands, because your hands have no product to be satisfied with. But if somebody is working with their hands and somebody is bringing about means to feed their family, doing things that provide sustenance for their house, we can be satisfied with that. One of the most enjoyable things in a natural way for me is when you've got this job in front of you, and when the job is in front of you, just you're looking at all the different things you have to do. And as you're looking at it, you're like, man, we're going to be here a while. And then when it's finally done, when the job is over, and you finally finish that, what you set out to do, I mean, I don't know about you, but what's the reaction? That's how I am when the job is done. Just, you know what that is? That's being satisfied with the labor of our hands, being satisfied with the bread that it provides, or satisfied with the outcome of the situation. We had a big mess in our yard this past week, Saturday before last, during one of those storms that blew through. We had hail that came through our house, and our pecan trees have really been shedding this year. I don't know about yours, but ours have really been shedding. But during this storm, one of those main beams coming off the trunk very low, about that big around, just decided, I'm done. It gave up the ghost and over it went. And our whole yard was full of sticks and limbs and branches and leaves, and unfortunately a lot of really green pecans that aren't going to be worth anything because they fell too early. But I looked at all that. I knew it was more than I could tackle by myself. I got a few people to help me with it, and thank the good Lord, our house and our yard is now cleaned back up. My point is this, when I was first looking at it, I was just like, my goodness. I can look at that area now where it was and say, I'm glad that's done. You know, a man that tills his land, he is satisfied with the bread that it produces because he is the one who the Lord has blessed through that labor to produce it. Now, it's interesting that Solomon uses this as an example of satisfaction. You know why that's interesting? Because tilling land is a result of what? It's a result of sin. It's a result of the curse. Because God cursed the ground for our sake. In the sweat of our face, we eat bread, and it brings up thorns and thistles, and we've got to kill it to get those things out. So how is it that we can be satisfied with something that is a result of sin? The reason we can be satisfied is because of what the psalmist says in Psalm 103, in about verse 14, 104 in about verse 13, when he's talking about the goodness and the majesty of the Lord, he says, the hills shall bring forth, and the rivers shall bring forth, and the earth shall be satisfied with the fruit of thy hands. In other words, this land in which we dwell, this world in which we are on, is still able to produce because God has made it in such a way that even though sin curses it, it can still produce the way God originally designed it. It can still bring forth fruit. It can still bring forth good things for us. And because God has been that good to us, and even though we're cursed by sin, we can still be satisfied with the labor of our hands. Now let's think about what our hands produce. Thinking about what our hands do, Can we be satisfied with the things that they produce and the things that they do for us? Now, this one's going to be tough because this is not going to be any kind of an excuse for gluttony. But notice what the prophet Joel writes in Joel chapter 2. As he's describing the Lord blessing the fruit of our hands, as he talks about blessing us and the labor that we go through. In Joel chapter 2 and about verse 19, and I'm going to have to pick and choose here. Y'all pray for me. I have a lot of verses I want to bring in, and I've had to really pare this list down, and you pray that I go to the right place. But in Joel chapter 2 and about verse 19, it talks about how the Lord will satisfy His people with corn, with wine, and with oil that is brought forth. And as he talks about us being satisfied with corn and wine and oil, he then goes on in verse 26 to say this. He says, they shall eat in plenty and be satisfied. Not only can we be satisfied when we work to produce a certain thing, we can be satisfied whenever we begin to partake of that thing. Now, I know a lot of us today, we could always eat another bite, right? It's all right. Because you know how it goes. You've eaten and you've eaten and you've eaten. Take Thanksgiving. You've just stuffed yourself with turkey. You've stuffed yourself with dressing. You've stuffed yourself with all the things there at the table. And you're like, I cannot eat another bite. And someone says, we've got pumpkin and pecan pie. I'll have a piece. You can always have another bite, right? Thank you. I got one honest fellow over here. I mean, we say we've had our sufficiency. We say we've had enough, and we have. But we could always eat another bite. And it doesn't matter how much money you have. Nobody's going to turn down another dollar, are they? I mean, I don't know about you, and I know it's getting worth less and less and less, but do any of you still pick up pennies when you find them on the ground? I do. You know why? It may only be a penny, but it's free. You want free money? Pick it up off the ground. That's where free money is found. But you know, we could always say, I could use another dollar. I could have another bite. But here it says that the Lord will give us corn and wine and oil, and we shall be satisfied with that. And then it says, we shall eat in plenty and be satisfied therewith. What is the Lord here describing? He's describing not that we have a situation where it meets all the carnal desires of man, but he's talking about a situation where God has not only blessed us with having a sufficiency, but He's blessed us to have an abundance. He's blessed us to have plenty. He's blessed us to be overflowing. And because of that, we have a situation where we can eat and be satisfied, when we can rejoice in the goodness of God, when we can rejoice in all the things He's given for us. I tell you, when you consider the world in which we live in today, when you consider the time in which we live today, we have absolutely no reason to complain and have every reason to be satisfied with what God has blessed us with, because just in a natural way, I can tell you, friends, that I have had a sufficiency and I've also eaten in plenty, and the Lord has very graciously prospered the labors of people's hands here in this country. I am a product of a generation of people who have lived to enjoy the fruits of labors that were sown by others that came generations before. My people haven't been in this country all that long, relatively speaking. My father's folks came in the late 1800s, the 1880s. My mom's folks came around the turn of the century. So we hadn't been in this country nearly as long as some folks have. But just in the time of my folks being in this country, on my mom and dad's side, think about all the things that other generations have labored to provide for us. The whole world was engaged in conflict in 1914. And through the help and the assistance of people in this country, that conflict was won in 1918. The world was again engaged in conflict in 1937 and 1938. And in 1941, this country became involved, and through the labors of people in this country, that worldwide conflict was won. What do you think the world would look like today if the world had lost either one of those two conflicts with the people that they were fighting against? Now, I'm not up here to make a political speech, but just think about the things that they were fighting. Think about the forces that were at play. By the Lord blessing previous generations to conquer those folks, we have a whole lot more pleasant situation today than we would have otherwise.
I am a living product, and so are you, of the wisdom of men that lived over 200 years ago that set up a country that was designed to give people liberty and freedom, not only to live and not only to work, but to also assemble and to worship and to do all the various things that we've always known all of our lives. I tell you, the Lord has given unto us corn and wine and oil in sufficiency, and He has blessed us to eat in plenty. And I tell you, friends, we have every reason to be satisfied with not only the labor and the product of men's hands that God has blessed them with, but the situation we find ourselves in, that we have not just enough. We don't just have a sufficiency. We have an overflowing plenty in which we can be satisfied in this world in which we live. So the first realm in which we can be satisfied, biblically speaking, is by bread, if you will, the product of things, of labors. And the second realm we'd like to discuss was actually pointed out a couple weeks ago at our annual meeting. Brother James was in this particular passage on Friday night, I believe. It's found in Psalm 65. In Psalm 65, it's actually the verse that he was reading from, verse 4. When he says, "Blessed is the man that walketh in thy counsel." And as that verse finishes, it says this. It says, "We shall be satisfied with the goodness of thy house and of thy holy temple." Here it says, "We shall be satisfied with the goodness of thy house." Now I want you to notice what the psalmist is here talking about. He's talking about a situation. He's talking about a circumstance, a place that we find ourselves that is not only sufficient. I hope to prove that it's overflowing. What is sufficient about God's house? And what's overflowing about God's house? What is it for us to be satisfied about in God's house? I can tell you what I'm not satisfied with in God's house. I'm not satisfied with my performance in it. How about you? I'm not satisfied with how I've labored in the kingdom. How about you? I'm not satisfied that I have shown her the honor and the respect that she is deserving of. How about you? I'm convinced that there is room for improvement in my life, in God's house. How about you? But here's something else I'm convinced of. I'm convinced that when it comes to the goodness and the wisdom of how she's set up and how she functions and how she operates, I'm satisfied, friends, that what God established in His house, He got it exactly right, and it needs no improvements, it needs no updates, it needs no adjustments, no additions, and no subtractions. I know a lot of people today think, well, you know, this may have been good for this time, but it's no longer good now. Yeah, well, maybe back in that time, men only preached, but now it's all right for a woman to preach. I'm going to tell you something, friends. The way God set it up, He set it up once for all time, because He has delivered the faith once unto the saints, and it needs no improvements and it needs no updates. God's house is good. It's full of goodness. It's full of things and richness that God has given to us. I'm satisfied that she needs no moral adjustment to stay up with the season. Please, it's just the us's here, so y'all bear with me for a little while. It doesn't matter what the world says about divorce. It doesn't matter what the world says about homosexuality. It doesn't matter what the world says about murder. It doesn't matter what the world says about adultery. Those things are just as they've ever been in the eyes of God, and they should ever be that way in the eyes of His church. And friends, I'm satisfied that what we have here is good. I'm satisfied that what God has placed here is righteous. I'm satisfied, friends, that when I come to the house of God, while I need to improve my walk within her, I know, friends, she doesn't need improvement because she was given perfectly by the hand of her husband, Jesus Christ the Lord. But there's something else in God's house that brings about satisfaction. It's not just the goodness of His house. It says, "We shall be satisfied with the goodness of thy house." But you go a few Psalms prior, in Psalm 36, and about verse 8, he has this to say about God's house. He says, "We shall be satisfied." I thought I could quote this one. There's too many verses running together. Psalm 36 doesn't start with "We shall be satisfied." I can't remember how it starts. Psalm 36, verse 8. "They shall be abundantly satisfied with the fatness of thy house, and thou shalt make them drink of the river of thy pleasures." Here he says there is some satisfaction And this satisfaction that is had is from abundant fatness in God's house. Now, y'all please stay with me. Let's keep our mind in the right place. There is a sense in the Bible in which fatness is a good thing. Please hear me out. Fatness being a good thing doesn't necessarily mean what our waistline looks like, but fatness being a good thing in Bible is descriptive of having extra. It's described as having an enrichment, and it's described as having not just sufficiency, but an overflowing. And here, God's house is not just described as having fatness. It's described as being abundantly fat. In other words, you don't just find something here that's good. You find something here that's abundantly good. You don't just find something here that's extra. You find something that's abundantly extra. What does this remind you of? It reminds me of Ephesians chapter 3. As Paul is closing his prayer, when he says, "Now unto him that is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that worketh in us, to him be the glory in the church, world without end. Amen." A lot of times we get focused on the exceeding abundantly above. Where is the exceeding abundantly above? Where does it happen? How does it transpire? Where does it take place? It takes place according to the power that is within us. To him be the glory where? In the churches, world without end. Amen. Where is God abundantly fat to his people? Where is there an enrichment and an overflowing of goodness? It's found in things being exceeding abundantly above in the churches of Jesus Christ, in the house of our God. And friends, this is a situation that we can be satisfied with. This is a situation that we can rest in. This is a situation that we can find comfort in like nowhere else, because here we have fatness and goodness that this world knows nothing of. I tell you what's been just a blessing to me. It's been a blessing to me, not just over the course of my entire life, but more particularly in recent days. Now, I realize that when we get together, I mean, it's not just that world events don't matter anymore. I know they still matter. It's not that when we're together we never talk about world events. We still do. But you know, I've been just so glad over the last 4 or 5 months to have one place, if nowhere else, one place that I could come and just shut all this stuff out for a little while. I tell you, friends, it's been just sometimes overflowing, just bending. The things that we've just been pounded with and pounded with and pounded with days upon days upon days. I just sometimes like to come and sit down with people that I love in a situation where all that's going on out there, just for a little while, it melts and it fades from view. Remember what Jesus told his disciples in, I believe it's in John chapter 6. Right before he fed the multitude with 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, Jesus had been in a quarter, in an area where it just been one thing after another happening. People had been coming and he'd been healing them. People had been coming and he'd been preaching to them. The disciples had been busy preaching, and the disciples had been busy, and they'd had just such a season. And it wasn't a bad season. It was just such a busy season. It was just such a lot going on. Here's what Jesus said. He says, "Come ye apart into the desert and rest a while." That's what I look forward to when I come to the house of God. It's meeting with my Master as he says, "Come out into the desert for a little while and rest a while with me." You know, in a desert, you shouldn't find grass. I'm talking to a lot of wonderful Georgians who live in the green south. Have y'all ever been to the desert? All right, let me explain the desert to you. The desert is miles and miles and miles and miles and miles of nothing but the same thing. Whenever we would drive all those summers from California to Texas to visit family every summer for a couple of weeks, Mom would go to sleep somewhere in Southern California right before the Arizona line. She would sleep almost all the way through Arizona. Sometimes she did sleep through Arizona and wake up somewhere in New Mexico. And when she woke up and she'd look around, she'd see country that looked just like it was when she was asleep, gone to sleep hours before. And she would say, "Lord sure loved this country. He made a lot of it," and go right back to sleep. That's what the desert is. Miles and miles and miles of the same thing. And every now and then you look and you're like, "Ooh, there's something out there. Maybe it's a mountain. Maybe it's a rock. Maybe it's a tree." But if you ever find a tree in the desert, be sure that's some of the few water there is in the desert, because that's the only way that tree grows. But you know what you don't find in the desert? You don't find grass. But it says there, when he fed the multitude, they were in the desert. But what did he command the people to do? He commanded them to sit down, for there was much grass in the place. So there was grass in a place that no grass should have been. There wasn't much food, but the food was sufficient and abounding for the multitude that was there, that God was able to take just a little bit, blessed to feed a whole lot of folks, and have more left over than he started with. So you've got food in the desert, you've got grass and a place of comfort to rest in the desert, and a place, friends, that should not naturally be. And yet it's a place of comfort, it's a place of peace, it's a place of satisfaction, it's a place of tranquility. Everyone ate. They were filled. They had more left over than they started with. None of this should have been happening according to nature, but it did. Why? Because God was there and God was in the place. Friends, this place should not be blessed like it is. We're sinners walking in the courts. We have impure thoughts. We have impure actions. We make bad decisions. I've already told you this whole sermon is based on a realization that I came to, that I've been wrong in my approach of the subject satisfaction or satisfied all these years. I mean, we get things wrong. We do things wrong. We don't treat each other right. We do so many things that are out of bounds and out of concert with God's will. And yet this place is a place of rest. It's a place of tranquility. It's a place, friends, where there should be no place to rest, but there is. There should be no food to eat, but there is. And the food that we have, it doesn't just suffice. There's more and abounding and overflowing fatness in this place. You know what that is? That's God's house being a place where we can be satisfied. It's a place, friends, where we can meet with the Master and just shut out all this other stuff for a little while and find rest for our soul. The psalmist says, "We shall be satisfied with the goodness of thy house, even of thy holy temple." Friends, we realize that our temples are bad. We realize that we make mistakes and these bodies go so far astray. And yet these very bodies are the very temple in which the Holy Ghost comes down and He makes His abode with us. And when all these temples start meeting together in God's house, and His Spirit is felt, and His presence is strong, and we see, friends, the goodness of God, and experience the abundant, overflowing fatness of God's house, we can find satisfaction that we cannot find anywhere else in the affairs of men, in the labors of men, or any other situation we might find ourselves in here in this world. So we can be satisfied with bread. We can be satisfied with God's house. What's the third thing that we can be satisfied with here in this world? And we'll try to move from this one and bring it back again, as we said, to Psalm 17 and verse 15. In Isaiah 53, we read about something that is foretelling Christ, the suffering that He would go through. And I know this is talking about Christ because this is where the Ethiopian eunuch was reading in Acts 8, and Philip comes to him and he says, "Understandest thou what thou readest?" He says, "How can I, except some man should guide me?" And he brings him up into the chariot and he starts at that very same place and preaches unto him Jesus. So I know Isaiah 53 is about Jesus. And for the sake of time, let's click to the middle of all this in about verses 10 and 11. I'd love to back up into verse 1, but starting about verse 10 and 11, it talks about the Lord putting him to grief. How the Lord had made His soul an offering for sin. It talks about how Jesus would see His seed. He would prolong His days. And the pleasure of the Lord would prosper in His hand. Notice verse 11. In verse 11 it says, "He shall see of the travail of His soul and be satisfied. By His knowledge shall My righteous servant justify many, for He shall bear their transgressions." Here we find something that it says that God Himself is satisfied with. Without belaboring the point, I want to tell you the Father is satisfied with the work of Jesus Christ, the Son is satisfied with the work of Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost is satisfied with the work of Jesus Christ. They're in full agreement that what needed to be executed was executed by Christ at Calvary. some 2,000 years ago. And I'd like to very quickly do an extended reading in your presence from Jeremiah 31, where it talks about how this situation should affect us. God is satisfied with it. God is satisfied with His own works. God is satisfied with the work that He did in creation because He looked upon it and said it was good and very good. But God's satisfied with the work that He did in redemption. And how should that affect us today? Jeremiah 31, the setting for this in verse 3 is when the Lord appears to him and says, "Yeah, I've loved thee with an everlasting love, therefore with loving kindness have I drawn thee." And He starts talking to Israel particularly about being restored from captivity, how they're going to go into bondage, but they're going to come back out of bondage. But then in verse 10, the Lord broadens this out. He speaks to more than just Israel. He speaks to many different kinds of people. Jeremiah 31 in verse 10, it says, "Hear the word of the Lord, O ye nations, and declare it in the isles afar off, and say, He that scattered Israel will gather him and keep him as a shepherd doth his flock. For the Lord hath redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he. Therefore they shall come," notice this next phrase, "they shall come and sing in the height of Zion, and shall flow together to the goodness of the Lord for wheat and for wine and for oil and for the young of the flock and of the herd, and their soul shall be as a watered garden, and they shall not sorrow any more at all. Then shall the virgin rejoice in the dance, both young men and old together. For I will turn their mourning into joy, and will comfort them, and make them rejoice from their sorrow." Notice verse 14, "And I will satiate," that word satiate means satisfying, "I will satiate the soul of the priest with fatness, and my people shall be satisfied with my goodness, saith the Lord." In this expression, the Lord has moved out from describing just the general return of Israel from captivity. And He's speaking to all nations. And as He's speaking to all nations, He's talking about His redemption. He's talking about His salvation. How He has ransomed people. And what is the result of this? The result of this is that when they come to Zion, and when they come to the place where singing is done, where shouting is done, they're going to talk about this. They're going to sing about this. They're going to sing about their fatness, their oil, their wine, and their wheat. They're going to talk about the goodness of the Lord, but they're also going to be satiated and satisfied with what? With me. With who I am. With what I've done. With my work and my salvation. I tell you, it would be enough, and it is enough, that God is satisfied with His own work. It would be enough, and it is enough, that God is satisfied in heaven right now. That everyone that Jesus Christ was supposed to redeem, He did. That everyone that is supposed to be with Him in heaven will be. That is enough, friends. But it should be that God, sending His Son into this world, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them who are under the law, that should satisfy us as well. I tell you, friends, when you think about God's goodness to people like us, when you think about God's righteousness to people like us, we were deserving of nothing. We were deserving of hell and eternal punishment. And yet, He gave us His Son. And not only that, He gave us His Son's righteousness. And not only that, He gave us His Son's home and His Son's inheritance. Friends, we should be satisfied with God's goodness. We should be satisfied with God's work, God's salvation, and God's character and who He is. I'll tell you something, friends, there's a lot of God's people who aren't. You start talking about free unmerited salvation. You talk about free sovereign grace. You talk about election. You talk about predestination. That will make people mad. And friends, I'm not just talking about people that are going to hell that are goats. I'm talking about God's people. Get mad about that. You know why they get mad about that? Because they're not satisfied with salvation being free by God's hand and Jesus Christ's work alone. I tell you, it ought to satisfy us. God's work ought to satisfy us, and it can. Because where does this happen? Notice back in verse 12, it says, "Therefore they shall come and shall sing in the height of Zion, and shall flow together to the goodness of the Lord." What is it we're satisfied with? His goodness. What is the height of God's goodness? What is it that we flow to? We should flow to the very sacrifice of Jesus Christ Himself and be satisfied that what needed to be done has been done. What needed to be accomplished has been accomplished. And friends, that's something to sing about. That's something to shout about. I tell you, you can be so down in the mud and the weeds of this whole world, and you lose the sense of what it is you're supposed to sing about. You lose the sense if you even have something to sing about. Remember what the psalmist writes? We don't know who wrote this psalm. We know it was written during captivity. And in Psalm 137, the psalmist writes about them being in captivity, a place that Jeremiah is foretelling they're going to come out of. And not only they're going to come out of captivity, there's going to come ultimate deliverance, ultimate salvation. And what does it say about being in captivity? It says, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our hearts upon the willows of the river Kibar in Babylon. And they that took us captive required of us myrrh. And they that held us in bondage said, sing us a song of thy country. And verse 4 of Psalm 137 says, how shall we sing the Lord's song? Sing, we're in a strange land. I tell you something, friends, when you're out there and the world's just beating down upon you day after day, minute after minute, moment by moment, sometimes it feels hard to sing the Lord's song because you feel like you're in a strange land. Sometimes, friends, when you've had just a week, it was one thing after another, just one thing, and sometimes right before you think, I'm going to finish this and we'll be done for a little bit, right before that's done, something else happens. I got something else. Right before that's happened, you got something else. I mean, I had 3 days this week at work when I went to work saying, I've got one thing I got to get done by the end of the day. And I shouldn't take all that long to do it. So I wasn't being a government worker. I was not trying to stretch that one task over the course of the whole day. But I said, this is all I have to do today. Before I'd even been there an hour, I had 3 more suspenses that were all due by the close of business. And it was just like, I don't know if I can get this done. Come Friday, I was still working on suspenses until after 5 o'clock because somebody, somewhere, in some high-ranking position, probably the stars on their shoulder, I guess, I don't know, said, this has to be done by the end of the day. I didn't really see the point of it myself, but I had to do it. Have y'all never had weeks like this? Just one thing after another. And then you come home and there's things to be done at the house. I already told you about the cleanup we had to do. We had other stuff had to be done. It's just one of those weeks. And things are just coming at you, coming at you, coming at you, over and over and over again. And sometimes when you have those moments, you may have gone hours, not intentionally, but just gone hours and said, you know, I hadn't prayed lately. With all I'm going through, I should have. Sometimes you take a moment just say, I need to catch my breath. And when you try to catch your breath, you think, what would make me feel better? And you can't come up with anything. You know, it ought to be that a song on our lips will be enough to liven the darkness and the doldrums of whatever situation we're in. But sometimes, friends, when you try to think about something to raise your spirit, you can't think of anything. I'll just confess, that's my life. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? How can I get joy in this dark place in which I live? They that come to Zion shall flow unto the goodness of God. They shall sing and they shall shout. I tell you, friends, I didn't come here this morning to relive suspenses that I went through this week. I didn't come here today to go through any of the other things that I went through this week. I came here today, I hope, to flow into the goodness of God in Mount Zion, to remember again and recall to mind the things that He has left us for our comfort, for our benefit, for our joy, to be satisfied in the goodness of God. Because, friends, it should be that no matter what the circumstances out there are, that I can be satisfied in the goodness of God and be satisfied in the righteousness of Jesus Christ. But I confess to you that too many times I've been out there and forgotten about God's goodness. I've been out there and been so tied up and busy, I hadn't had time to think about God's goodness. And I need to come to the house of God. I need to come to Mount Zion. I need to come with singing and shouting all over again and be reminded all over again about how good God is, how much He loves His children, and just how finished and sure the work of Jesus Christ is. And if I can be, if God can be satisfied in what Jesus Christ has done, may we be satisfied in what Jesus Christ has done. Now, very quickly, so much more I want to say about all that, but so much more. But very quickly, back in Psalm 17 and verse 15, David is describing, after all the events of his life are over, after all of this is said and done, he said, "As for me," he said, "here's my hope. My hope is that I'm going to awake and I'm going to behold thy face in righteousness, and I'm going to be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness." Think about the three things that we have talked about, friends. The three ways in which we can be satisfied here in this world. The very first way was partially through the works of our hands, but through the blessing God has given us of our hands to produce things like bread and things like sustenance. Well, that doesn't quite apply in heaven, because there won't be any works of our hands in heaven. But I tell you what there will be in heaven. There'll be bread. There'll be fatness. There'll be all the things that God has promised. Because what does Jesus say of Himself? He says, "I am the bread of life that came down from heaven." We're going to have bread in heaven. His name is Jesus Christ. And it's satisfying. We'll be satisfied when we awake with His likeness. Say something else we'll be satisfied with. We'll be satisfied with God's house when we get home to glory. I've had people ask me so many questions about heaven. So many questions that I just don't have the answer to. I wish I did. Wish I could tell somebody just how good it was. Wish I could tell myself how glorious it is. But I just don't have the words for it. But here's what I do know. It ain't going to be disappointing. There's not going to be anybody that walks into heaven and goes, "Is this it?" That's not going to happen. You know why? Because what's going to happen is the same thing that happened to the Queen of Sheba when she came to Solomon. I mean, the Queen of Sheba made a journey to visit Solomon, a journey that likely took her the better part of a year, if not an entire year. A journey on camels from a very far land. And friends, if you know anything about camels, they can only make one of those journeys a year. So they have to rest for a while after they make that kind of a journey before they can turn around and make it back. If you want to know all about camels, we'll talk about that later. But anyway, so she made this journey that took the better part of a year, if not a whole year. Had to leave her land in the hands of somebody else to rule in her absence. Just to come visit a man who she didn't believe was all that and then some like she heard he was. I tell you, would you make a journey that cost you all year, had to put all your affairs in the hands of somebody else to give attention to while you're gone, and spend a whole year going to see somebody just to prove him wrong? I tell you, that's tough right there. I don't know if you ever thought about that, but she did that just to prove the report wrong. But when she got there, not only did she find out that everything she'd been told was right, she said, "Verily it was a true report, which I heard of thee." This is 1 Kings chapter 10. "Verily it was a true report that I heard of thee in my home country. When I saw the splendor of thy house, when I saw thy ascent and the way that you went up into the house of God, when I saw the attendance of your servants, when I saw the gold and the richness of your kingdom, and when I heard the wisdom coming out of your mouth," she said, "verily, the half was not told unto me. Happy are thy servants, and with joy they do service to you." Friends, she said, not only is everything I heard true, I mean, it wasn't even half of how good all this is. Friends, I don't know all that you've heard about heaven, all that you've heard about God, all that you've heard about His work, but I can assure you the very best you've ever gotten is half the story. And when you get to heaven, you're going to say, "Man, not only is it everything I heard, it's all that and then some." We're going to be satisfied with the splendor of God's house, with the majesty of God's house, but we're going to be very satisfied with the goodness and the fatness of this house. Because there's not going to be any of this looking around going, "Well, so-and-so's not here." There's not going to be any of this looking around going, "Well, this isn't the same size crown that I thought I was going to get." I tell you, heaven's going to be so majestic, it's going to be so more glorious than we can possibly imagine here, that we are going to be fully satisfied, not just having a sufficiency, but an overflowing abundance at the goodness and the fatness of God's house. And I'll tell you something everybody's going to be satisfied with when we get to heaven. There's not going to be a single person in heaven who is dissatisfied with the work of Jesus Christ our Savior. I've heard preachers say this in the past, and I know what they mean by it. So please bear with me. I've heard preachers in the past say this. They mean well, but it sometimes can give the wrong impression. They say, everybody is going to be an old Baptist in heaven. I know what they mean by that. But some people have taken that to mean that we think that only old Baptists are going to be in heaven. That's not what that statement means. Here's a better way of saying it. Everybody's going to believe the truth in heaven. Everybody's going to be satisfied with the truth in heaven. There's not a one of us who are going to be standing there in heaven going, well, Lord, I'm glad I could help you out with this. We're going to be in heaven and our knees are going to hit the deck and bow in submission and say, thank you, Lord, for all that you did to this poor benighted soul. Thank you for all of your benefits, all of your wondrous mercies, and all of thy glory. Because, friends, when we see that face in righteousness, when we awake with his likeness, it's going to be apparent on that day that everything we have and everything that's been done was not accomplished by anything we did, but fully accomplished by the hand of one man, that blessed man, Jesus Christ, our Lord. We're going to be satisfied with his bread. We're going to be satisfied with his house. And we're going to be satisfied with his work some sweet day in heaven. May it be our case that we're satisfied with provision now. We're satisfied with his house now. We're satisfied with his work and salvation now. And may it be that these are the guiding principles that our satisfaction can be had even when we're out there among the trials and the cares of this life. That even we can be satisfied when things are pounding us from all sides, and that we can be satisfied even sometimes in situations where we shouldn't be, because, friends, the church is dwelling and has been dwelling in a land that just seems impossible. May it be that our lives, we see the impossible in our lives by being satisfied with the work of God and satisfied with his goodness and his fatness. And may the Lord add his blessings unto us, that if we do these things, we'll be so happy and we'll be so uplifted and joyful in this world in which we live that people will look at us and wonder and behold our good works and glorify our Father which is in heaven. I hope these things have been a blessing unto you. If they have, may we go forth from this day satisfied in the goodness of God's house. If these things have been a blessing unto you, give them all the praise, honor, and glory. May the Lord bless you, my friend.